Hello and welcome to the Classical Tulsa Podcast. I'm Jason Heilman. My guest today from her home in Sacramento is Laura Downs. Laura has been called one of the foremost American pianists of her generation, but she's really much more than that. In addition to her career as a performer and a recording artist, who's released more than a dozen albums to date, Laura is also an essayist, a radio host, and an activist seeking to expand the ways we think about music in America. On this podcast, we'll find out about some of Laura's latest projects, including her most recent albums, her ongoing interview series for NPR, and her new record label, Rising Sun Music. Laura, thank you for talking to us today.
It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you had a busy 2020 while the rest of us were trying to find toilet paper, I think. You had three albums come out last year. Is that right?
I think that's
right.
Am I
counting that correctly?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I didn't have anything else to do. So.
That's the maybe one of the benefits of being a pianist, I guess,
yeah,
is
that's right.
You're at home with the instrument already.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about some of those albums. One of them I featured pretty heavily recently, and that's your album of Florence Price Discoveries. Tell us, how did that album come about?
Oh, I have a long history with Florence Price. Way back, I'm going to say it's 15 years ago by now, when I was really first trying to investigate, you know, a little bit under the surface of American music and find out some basic things like where are the women, where are the composers of color, they've got to be here somewhere. I found Florence Price in an old anthology from the 90s called A Century of Music by Black Women Composers. I found her first Fantasy Negra, and I started playing that piece a lot in concerts. Fell in love with the sound of it, like this really, to me at that time, new sound, you know, of blended traditions. It's a fantasy based on melodies from a spiritual, and just also saw the reaction that it would cause with audiences who were also, you know, so intrigued.
And that fantasy was, you put that on your 2016 album, America Again, didn't you?
That's right.
So you've been featuring that particular piece in the repertoire for a while.
Yeah.
But then it led to much more.
Because of that recording. Because that, you know, that recording hit a chord. It was 2016. Mm-hmm. And I put out this album that was, you know, about the diversity of American music and really who, you know, who it comes from and why. So as a result of that recording, I was invited to do a residency at a university down in Texas. And my host, a musicologist named Michael Cooper, took me out to dinner the first night. And I got him all excited about Florence Price because that was not too long. Remember, in 2009, there was that discovery of all of her manuscripts,
yes,
these boxes and boxes of manuscripts of hers, right? Abandoned house outside of Chicago, a young couple was renovating the house and just found these completely, you know, destroyed and disorganized manuscripts. And they ended up down in the library at University of Arkansas. So I'm talking to Michael at dinner and getting all excited about what might be in those boxes. And he, a couple of weeks later, took some sabbatical time and some, you know, and some research money and went down there and started going through the boxes. And right at the same time, Shermer had acquired the catalog. So everything kind of moved ahead into sort of a new phase of activity. And I'm learning all this music. So I decided I'm going to kind of document this discovery process. And so I ended up making that recording really quickly. Just as I was learning the music, I was recording it. It was a really beautiful deep dive, you know, into her world. And finished that recording really just before the pandemic started.
That was your first album release from last year. Your second proved to be even more prescient. Tell us about Some of These Days.
Right. So Some of These Days was an album that I started working on, oh, I guess, you know, 2 years ago. And another branch, I guess, of the work I've been doing over many years of looking at American music and its roots, right? And at a certain point, I realized, well, really, everything goes back to the same place. Really, everything goes back to the beginning, you know, the way things do. And if we're looking at this country, our first national music, our first music born on this soil is the music of African Americans and slavery, the spirituals. And, you know, those form the basis of most every American genre, if you look deep enough. And certainly through my work with Florence Price, through a piece like her Fantasy Negra that's based on a spiritual, through, you know, the music that we know of the composers who were working in the 20s and 30s, that time in the, you know, Harlem Renaissance, when all of these different influences came together. For me, that was really an inroad into kind of examining the pathway that had led to the music that I had been exploring for all these years. So Some of These Days is, it's a collection of freedom songs and spirituals and kind of different treatments of these songs that we know so well. Everything from strict concert arrangements to collaborations with artists like the Chapin Sisters, you know, in folk arrangements and jazz settings. And I'd been living with this music for over a year. The album was scheduled to come out at the beginning of April. And I had, you know, my spring and summer set aside to be on tour, promoting the album, playing concerts. The pandemic hit and I really didn't know what to do about the project, you know. It was unclear whether it even made sense to put out an album. But I had spent the Christmas holiday writing my liner notes for the record. And as I did that, as I went through the track list and I started writing about the messages and the histories behind each of these songs, I realized how global the experience of suffering and survival and overcoming always is. It was really a very deep emotional experience to do that. And I really remember that feeling of like, oh, this is capturing one specific time and place, and it's not, it's everything. So I decided to go ahead and put the album out because we were all in this moment of intense grief and suffering and like not knowing what was going to come next. And I thought this music has lessons for us now.
And then just a couple months after the album came out, the moment really changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Black Lives Matter movement didn't start last year, of course, but it took hold in a way that I think maybe nobody was anticipating. Mm-hmm. How did that resonate for you, having just released this album?
And I should say, too, you know, the other place that this album came from in me is from my parents and their involvement in the civil rights movement. That's where they met. You know, they were very young. And my dad, who was Black, who grew up in Harlem, and mom, who's Jewish from Ohio, met in San Francisco, you know, as a result of the movement. And so that's kind of part of my heritage, part of my DNA. When George Floyd was killed in May, and, you know, the country went through this, like, sort of shudder, right? This collective shudder. I think what happened was that I went from feeling really sad about the world to feeling mad. You know, like, we're going to do this again. Like, it's not, we keep doing this. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this music that I just put out, and for the first time, I felt like I really had something in my hands that I could do that was powerful and was kind of like a legacy from my parents and a legacy from everyone, like all of those ancestors back and back and back who have fought for this cause. I can't explain to you, it just gave me this window into the truth that, you know, yes, music is so powerful. It does have this way of bringing together the past and the present and the future and bringing about change. I could just feel, you know, that legacy. And so it has seen me through this year, honestly, to be with this music, to push it out there, to see where it goes and to witness the, I don't want to say comfort, it's not comfort, but the resonance, I think, the emotional support that it really can bring us when we're in this kind of a crisis and this kind of a moment of reckoning and shock.
What from this album do you think really speaks to that moment the most?
I don't know if there's a, if it, there's a way to slide it in, but one of the things that I remember when I was sitting in December and writing my liner notes, that recording of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, you know, where I sampled a 1939 field recording of these women in a penitentiary, a state penitentiary in Florida, you know, and it's like crackly ghost voices. And I'm thinking about these women who are imprisoned, you know, in the Jim Crow South. And of course, you know, they are separated from their families. But at the moment that I was writing these liner notes, we were separating families at our border, you know, so there was this feeling of the ways that we keep committing the same crimes, really, and how this experience of suffering, this experience of separation, how real it is, was, you know, will be.
There's definitely a very in-the-moment urgency to the album, but there are also some tracks that have more of a timeless quality to them. Are there some you might highlight?
I think there were two pieces, maybe, if that's okay, that really captured what I think I was feeling, what so many of us were feeling. The first is an arrangement of Billy Taylor's civil rights era anthem, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. And, you know, really that's where I just connected so deeply with the marches that my parents were part of, you know, and the marches that were happening down the street from me here in California in the state capitol, and just this feeling of energy, this feeling of change, you know, of progress happening now, like, you know, the urgency of it. And then conversely, there's the long arc of history, right? And some of the oldest songs on the album felt really powerful. There's Harry T. Burley's arrangement of The Spiritual Deep River, which I recorded with the Public Quartet on strings. And, you know, just these ancient melodies, right? These ancient rivers of melody. Those felt really, really potent and tangible to me as well.
Speaking with pianist Laura Downs. Laura, we've already heard two of your albums from last year. It wasn't your only album from the pandemic year, and really wasn't your only project. How did you continue to stay busy in 2020?
On March 9th, when the phone started ringing with all the cancellations, I really felt it hard. You know, I had a busy spring and summer and an exciting one, and I'd been working so hard to get ready for all these things. And then, you know, as you know, if you remember, everything came in waves, right? So first everything was canceled until May, and then June and July. And it was just emotionally so hard. Mm. So kind of to pick myself up, one of the things I did was to just start talking with friends. And it's funny because right before pandemic in February, I'd been on the road. I had been in Boston with a colleague, and in our hotel, I'd gone back to the hotel during the day for a nap, and I ran into another colleague who was in town for a different reason. And the three of us, all friends, we had dinner that night. And one of the things we talked about was how our touring life makes it really hard to maintain relationships. And we kind of had this moment about that, about like, how can we do better at just staying close to our friends? Mm-hmm. So when everything stopped and stood still, that's what I did. I reached out to friends, and it was a really good time to connect with my community, you know, of artists, of musicians, and just check in and sort of share the moment, not live it all by myself. And the conversations were so interesting because we were all really sad. We were all really struggling, and, you know, there was a lot of fear. But at the same time, we were quickly reimagining the purpose and the possibility of our work. You know, why do we do this work? We don't just do this work so that we fly on planes and go on stages and, you know, play for audiences and make money. We do this work for so many reasons, and, you know, some of those reasons are just like bone deep. You know, we were born this way. And at the same time, you know, there were all these other conversations happening sort of on the institutional level about change that needed to happen in the industry for all kinds of reasons, you know, just economy, equity, all of these changes that people were trying to imagine. But I felt like these conversations with artists were just a like a living document of this extraordinary time. So I had just done a Tiny Desk concert for NPR. So we were in touch about things. And I reached out and I said, you know, I'm having these conversations. I think they're really interesting. I think that they are capturing something really special. And NPR loved the idea of the project. We moved really quickly. And I started this show called Amplify with Lara Downs. I think we went live in September. And I'm talking to friends and colleagues, fellow artists, artists of color, people who are really change makers and visionaries and whose work has always been imagining a different future, you know, sort of creating a different future. And now I feel like in this strange time that's like a time of standstill and also transformation, there's such interesting work happening. And we've really, really been enjoying the process. So it's we're just heading into season two. And actually the first season, all of my guests were from the music world. Everything from my first guest was Rhiannon Giddens, and I spoke with Anthony McGill, Julia Bullock, Devon Tynes, and then my last guest this past year was John Batiste. And this season we're branching out to speak with all kinds of creatives who, you know, have different interactions, intersections with music, but really, because really the conversations aren't so much about music, they're about life. And so sort of casting a broad view, one of my guests coming up is Rita Dove. We had a beautiful conversation about the places where music and words come together, you know, how we express ideas with and without words. Yeah, it's been a wonderful experience. I've loved doing this.
It's a great series of interviews that are still available right now on NPR.org. I was going to ask you about it. There's a very diverse group of music makers there. I was wondering if any threads in common came out of these interviews, do you think?
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like we keep having the same conversation in some ways, and, you know, it's radically different each time. But I think that the common threads have to do with lineage, you know, and the shoulders that we stand on. And I think that at this time, there's a real awareness of that, because I think that there is a window here to really make change. You know, you and I are experiencing this in our little corner of the world as we're really trying to redefine the canon and really have a clearer understanding of where music by Black composers, for example, you know, where does that sit? Where does it come from? Where's it going? And I think that all of us in our work are feeling like we've been telling this story for a while. There's a new curiosity and a new openness to it. But I think there's, at the same time, I can't describe this so well. There's just this realization that everything that we do that we think is change making or groundbreaking or whatever, it's coming from a place, and that place is, you know, those who've come before us. So there's never really a first person to do anything, right? You're sort of picking up where someone else left off. I think that's the common thread, and just really being grateful for the history that holds us up, even though it's such a complicated history.
Well, that ties in really closely to something that I've read from you recently, and it allows me to segue into your latest project, which is your, is it right to call it a recording label, or is it something bigger than that? Tell us about Rising Sun Music.
Thank you for asking, and I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. It's just like a big thing that I'm doing. At the moment, it's a record label. Yes, it's a recording label. It is rapidly developing into a touring and performing project. It's definitely an education project. It's called Rising Sun Music. And, you know, after all these years of excavating and literally digging in boxes, you know, and finding music by Black composers and performing it and recording it and advocating for it, I felt like this was the time for me to kind of harness everything that I know and everything that I'm learning and everything that I don't know and create a platform, like a sort of a central hub. So I was awarded a generous grant from the Sphinx Venture Fund in the fall and launched Rising Sun Music this month with a first EP of music by Black composers. And the plan is to continue that on a monthly basis from here to eternity. I'm having so much fun discovering more and more and more. You know, I love rabbit holes, and it's so fascinating to find out just how much, how completely deep and rich this tradition is, and all the places that it intersects with music that we do know. So I'm feeling so energized and so grateful to be able to do this and to, you know, share these discoveries with listeners everywhere. The music is beautiful, and it really reshapes our understanding of, you know, of what classical music is and what we love about it.
Well, you just mentioned your new EP, Remember Me to Harlem. What brings these four very different pieces together?
Well, the title is a quote from Langston Hughes. It's from a letter he wrote, Remember Me to Harlem. And for me, Harlem has a few personal places of personal meaning. My dad grew up in Harlem. And I think Harlem is kind of like the place where the music that... Hang on, I need to figure out how to say this. It's so complicated. So briefly, the church where my dad grew up in Harlem, St. Philip's Church, used to be in the 19th century, was located downtown, right around the corner from the American Conservatory, which was founded in the 1890s. Dvorak came here to be the director of that conservatory, and in its halls, he met Harry T. Burleigh, who was, you know, the iconic interpreter and arranger of spirituals. And so Dvorak took the melodies that he learned from Burleigh and developed his sort of credo that, you know, American concert music should be based on these ancestral melodies. So for me, you know, it's almost like my birthplace in a generations removed sort of a way. But it's also the place where, you know, I enter into this space where Black composers are taking these themes of spirituals and integrating them with the European tradition and creating this music that we know and love from composers like Florence Price. So Harlem made sense as a place to start, and Harlem has been for generations and generations this hub of creativity. You know, it's a place of migration. It's a place where people come to find themselves and find each other and build community. And I mean, the stories, the wealth of stories, it's overwhelming. So I tried to just select a few examples of the kind of artistic renaissance and creativity that have come out of Harlem over the years.
Well, I was particularly struck by the very first track on the album, which is a piece by jazz legend Benny Golson, saxophonist maybe best known for his standard I Remember Clifford. Tell us about Classical Dreams. This is not something I've encountered before. Is this something that he did for you?
Yes. So Benny and I had a wonderful phone call the other day. Benny just turned 92 a few weeks ago. And what he told me, I didn't know until the other day. He has this deep love of the piano, and I was fortunate enough to come into his world many, many years ago. And he's sort of a father figure to me, and someone whose collaboration I've just treasured over the years. And he's written a few beautiful, beautiful piano pieces for me. But it turns out that piano was his first instrument. And piano is, you know, where he fell in love with music until he told me he was 14 and he heard a sax, and then he was hooked on that. But, you know, he grew up at the piano, and it really is his first love. And he writes so beautifully and expressively and romantically for the instrument. So yeah, this is a piece that he had sent to me years ago. And then for various reasons, I never got around to recording it until just now, and I'm so, so happy that it's the first piece of music on this project. You know, Benny is the last living member of that iconic photograph, A Great Day in Harlem, from 1958, with all of the greats of that generation. So, yeah, he has pride of place here.
That's not the only piece by a jazz legend on this EP. Tell us about the second track.
Right. So, you know, a place that has become so fascinating to me is this place where jazz and classical worlds collide. And we find this whole group of artists in the Black community who've gone back generations who had classical aspirations, classical beginnings, and then for obvious reasons found it difficult to enter the classical space professionally. This story repeats over and over again. And throughout the series, you'll find artists like Hazel Scott coming up in March, who, you know, was a classically trained artist who then, you know, went into jazz and sort of became an actress, singer. I mean, you know, it's the same story with Nina Simone, right? There are all these great artists who started with a love and a commitment to classical music. UB Blake is one of them. And this piece is actually an arrangement. It's a strange translation, really, of a song from his show Shuffle Along, which opened on Broadway exactly 100 years ago, 1921, the first all-Black hit show on Broadway. Langston Hughes called it the start of the Harlem Renaissance. It was just, you know, this incredible sensation with Josephine Baker in the cast and, I mean, the who's who, really, of the time. And the song is called Love Will Find a Way, and I just felt that it was so poignant this year, you know, in this time of isolation and separation. The song is about believing that, you know, no matter how gray the sky, how dark the days, that love will always find a way. And I think that translates itself without words in this piano arrangement that's by Jeremy Siskind, a wonderful arranger and composer.
You shift gears, maybe, or maybe not, for the next song on your new EP. Tell us about the collaboration you have on this song by William Grant Still.
Yeah, so you would think that this is a sharp shifting of gears, but actually guess who played the oboe in the pit for Shuffle Along? William Grant Still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you, all of these things, all these stories connect. It's wild. So this is his arrangement for oboe and piano of a song called Song for the Lonely, which he arranged for various instrumentations. But this is the first recording in the oboe piano version. And it's so beautiful. This is Titus Underwood, who's the first oboist of the National Symphony. Again, you know, I'm not sure why. I think I'm just so steeped in it that I'm choosing this music without realizing until afterwards how suited it is for this time, Song for the Lonely. It's very poignant, and there's this kind of like sighing quality to it, and it just makes me think about all of us, you know, in our collective loneliness this year. And I think the other thing that it really points out to me, you know, William Grant Still was the first everything, right?
Yeah.
The first African-American composer to be performed by a symphony orchestra, to have an opera performed, to have an opera on TV, to conduct a major orchestra. And I think it's, as we were saying earlier, it's lonely to be the first. Or to be perceived as the first. So there's a lot in this few little moments of beautiful music. And then the last piece on the EP, again, just really celebrates all of the collaboration, the creative energy that has come out of Harlem. It's a collaboration between Langston Hughes, you know, the sort of the center of the Harlem Renaissance, and the composer Margaret Bonds. And it's a song called When the Dove Enters In. And it's a song really about redemption, salvation, connection. It's about taking care of each other. Devon Tynes, brilliant bass baritone, and I first sight read this song together in February when we were working together on one of the last things I did live before pandemic. And it really struck a chord for us. And so it was really a pleasure to be able to record it and include it in this first collection of music on the Rising Sun series.
And this Margaret Bonds song is very striking. It's very much like a new spiritual in some ways.
It really is. I mean, in the manuscript, it's called a gospel song. And I love that too, because I think that, you know, when we're looking at the Harlem Renaissance and we're looking at this awareness of like a new Black culture and a high culture, right? A high art culture, but to celebrate that, to just celebrate the roots of this music and to embrace, I think, you know, the authentic voice that belongs to both parties, to Langston Hughes and to Margaret Bonds, you know, to go back to kind of their beginnings and make something so beautiful out of them.
So what do you have coming up next for Rising Sun Music?
Next month, being March, we have a focus on Phenomenal Women. That's the title of the EP. Music by Margaret Bonds, Florence Price, a beautiful piece by Hazel Scott, which really does celebrate her classical origins. Two collaborations on that EP, the soprano Nicole Cabell and the beautiful violinist Rachel Barton Pine. And then in April, it's a celebration of spring called Spring Fever.
And then you have some future collaborations and other artists planned that I've read about that you're wanting to maybe expand into or get into the Rising Sun Music family.
Yeah, these are composers going back about 200 years and then forward into the present day. So lots of living composers, lots of really young composers, Carlos Simon, Quinn Mason, Jesse Montgomery, commissioning some new work and making the recordings because, you know, I think that we can know things on one level. We can be intellectually aware of things, but this is a world of sound. And so we need to hear the music to love the music. And you know this, you know, from your world of making, trying to expand what we're hearing on the radio. The recordings need to be there and the recordings need to be good and they need to be fresh. And so what I'm trying to do is just infuse your library with new music and new stories so that we can really, you know, a year from now, I think that we'll have a different sound in our ears. I hope so.
So how can people find these new releases?
RisingSunMusic.org. There's a sign up form. You can be alerted about new releases anywhere that you like to stream your music, Apple, Spotify, Primephonic, any of the streaming platforms, and on your radio station and many radio stations around the country. Is that okay to say all that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
No, that's great.
Yeah, but I hope that people will reach out via the website and, you know, let us know what you would like to hear and how you're receiving this new music too. This is a two-way conversation, a multi-way conversation.
Well, I hope this is a bold new step towards a transformation of what we do get to hear going forward. Laura Downs, I could talk to you all day, but I will let you get on with your life. Thank you for speaking to us today.
Thank you so much for the great conversation.
That's all for this episode of the Classical Tulsa Podcast. For more on the classical music scene in northeastern Oklahoma and beyond, tune into my radio show, Classical Tulsa, every Friday at noon Central on Classical 88.7 KWTU HD1 and streaming at publicradiotulsa.org. Until next time, I'm Jason Heilman. Thanks for listening.